I thought the return was great when you sort of take it out of context and you say top 10 protected first round pick. I just it's disappointing that it's Cleveland because, you know, A, that's the team you're trying to beat if you're really trying to stay competitive this season. And, you know, sort of taking it abstractly, you know, like a game theory point of view, it's like you don't want teams to help the Cavs get out of the luxury tax. You want them to feel that pain and that sting. But at the same time, you know, it's hard to say no if you want what the rest of that deal is.
My guest today, Kevin Chouinard, host of ATL in 29 and also a writer for the Atlanta Hawks. I really appreciate you coming on. You can follow him at, this is where you would say your Twitter at.
I'll fill in. KLCHOUINARD.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah. I normally let guests say their Twitter handle so that I don't get it wrong and embarrass myself. So, the Atlanta Hawks have been in the news a lot lately. And I guess the best place to start would be the Kyle Korver trade, because I think it indicated to a lot of basketball fans and a lot of Hawks fans that the Hawks were ready to just initiate a teardown, rebuild. Then they take Paul Millsap off the market, and they've put together some good wins recently, but I think there are some question marks. So I guess my first question is, why trade Kyle Korver? What's the direction?
I think they just thought that trade offer was too good of an offer to refuse for a player, you know, who might only stay in Atlanta for, you know, another 3 months. Or nope, that's probably not enough. Maybe 4 months if things go well.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think if you look at all the little small signs, like I think there was a Mark Stein report, I want to say 4 or 5 days ago, that they were, you know, looking into signing Gary Neal.
Oh, okay. And
if you try to read between the lines on that, that seems like the kind of veteran signing that would indicate that they're not trying to break it up, but that they're trying to solidify things before the playoffs.
Well, conspiracy theorists would think that means they're moving on from Kent Bazemore, but I think that the realistic...
Well, no, that's a fair point. I would concur with that, except I would substitute in Tim Hardaway Jr. instead, because he's a pending free agent. So it still is a little bit, you know, up in the air. They might say, well, if we can get a fair return for Tim Hardaway Jr. and we don't think that we're going to be able to sign him as a restricted free agent at a price we like, then, you know, Gary Neal could be a backup for that. So, you know, it really could go either way. But I don't think it's Bazemore. I think they're, you know, he's still starting. He's starting to play pretty well the last week or so.
Yeah, he really
and
has.
And he had a knee injury that was bugging him most of the season. I don't think they've given up on him at all.
Yeah, that's not my impression either. I do feel like, you know, the Gary Neal thing is interesting, just insofar as it sort of represents this crossroads that they might be at. Because, I mean, one way you could interpret that is that they are going to go for it and sort of go that route. But you could, you know, maybe think that, okay, well, this gives them even more roster flexibility to move things around. It sort of implies that almost they're prepared to do both. That's my impression. Is that right, do you think? Or have they sort of recently affirmed or like really sort of are ready to bunker down with Paul Millsap and go forward with the team as currently constructed? How committed are they to that statement that they, I think they might have leaked that, but essentially from what I'm hearing out of the Hawks, they are not going to move Millsap and that they are going to try to make a run into the playoffs.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, if they haven't said that they didn't plan on trading Millsap, I think they said enough that he pretty much said it for them when he was asked some questions about it. So, you know, I think it's a fair indication that they're really trying to hold on to him, but, you know, I would never say never. I don't know that it's necessarily predicated on whether there are a bunch of wins and losses. I think it's more a matter of, you know, looking at the people that are going to be free agents, and the Hawks have had a lot of them. They started the season with 9 players who who were slated to be free agents this summer, and really just, you know, six people who would return, you know, if everybody stayed the same. So, you know, that was a lot of roster uncertainty, and that kind of, you know, left things open for them where they kind of have to decide, maybe even on a player by player basis, you know, is this a person we want to have back? You know, what's fair return if we trade them? And I think there's just a lot of key roster decisions to be made, independent of whether or not they want to, you know, make some sort of philosophical statement about whether they want to be competitive now or, you know, take a couple of years and rebuild, things like that. You know, when I asked Budenholzer about it prior to the Korver trade, you know, what was the mission statement? He said that it was sustained success. So, you know, if you take that at face value, you know, it doesn't sound like there's a rebuild in the offing.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that, you know, the Hawks are probably not going to go with this big explosion that I think some people are. I mean, from the outside anyways, I think that some people are just sort of waiting patiently by to see all of these fireworks and for a massive roster reconstruction thing. But, you know, I think that free agency point about last summer is interesting because I think that a lot of people forgot or have forgotten that the idea with the whole Dwight Howard signing was not to actually let Al Horford leave as an asset. It was to, you know, start Al Horford at power forward, have Dwight Howard at center, and then I think they actually had a trade ready to pull the trigger as far as Paul Millsap, you know, for a different player, so that they didn't actually lose a big free agent signing. And would you agree anyways that, you know, perhaps some of these moves and perhaps their reticence to have more uncertainty next summer is based on that they're maybe still, you know, smarting a little bit because of the way that the whole Al Horford situation unfolded?
Yeah. You know, if you sort of go through it event by event, you know, Dwight Howard signed before Al Horford made his decision. And, you know, I think if you look at the signing of Howard at that point in time, you know, the Hawks had two players who were cornerstone players, and that's Horford and Millsap. They are clearly the two players from, you know, the 60-win team that were the type of players you build a team around. And they were both going to be unrestricted free agents within a span of 12 months, you know, starting right then, July 1. So I think they felt like in signing Howard, not only were they getting a player who, you know, could be a productive center and a rebounder who could really change their fortunes on the glass, but they also felt like they were taking a hedge against, you know, the prospects of losing both of their cornerstones in a span of 12 months. Now, as far as, you know, whether or not they wanted to, I mean, it seemed like they definitely wanted to keep Horford, and then there were the reports that, you know, there were some trades for Millsap lined up, but I don't have any, you know, specific inside knowledge of them, but it's not crazy to think that that was a scenario that was happening.
Well, yeah, and I think that that's what they wanted the optimal outcome to be. I think that, you know, if you read in between the lines with the Hawks, and maybe you can confirm this one way or the other, they felt like, you know, we're not that far away from the 60-win team. And
sure,
if we sign Dwight Howard, keep Al Horford, and then move Paul Millsap, we basically just added Dwight Howard, and then, I mean, you could get, you know, potentially a star for Paul Millsap, and then, you know, if you could get a third star, now you sort of have a big three, one of them being, I think Dwight Howard is probably the original Kingslayer, if you look at that 2011 playoff series with the Orlando Magic. I think Dwight Howard seriously affects the whole dynamic with the way that the Hawks play against the Cavaliers. So I think that in the Hawks' mind, they really wanted this scenario to play out where they could either get a significant asset, maybe even a star for Millsap, and then have Al Horford and Dwight Howard and be reinvigorated and I mean, maybe arguably better than that 60-win team.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. You know, one is that that's a scenario that they could have been eyeing, and another is to look at what they have now. It seems kind of silly to want to necessarily blow it up.
Yeah,
when you sign Dwight Howard to a 3-year contract, which isn't really super long term, but at the same time, it's not short term, and you know, you'd think they would want to at least take one chance at the postseason with those two players together and have one full season with Millsap and Howard at least. But in, you know, looking again back to that 60-win team, you know, they made a lot of changes. Damari Carroll left, and they traded Jeff Teague over the summer again because it was a matter of return versus the practicality of all the free agents that they were going to have this summer. If you threw Jeff Teague into the mix, that would have been 10 players that would have been free agents in the summer of 2017. And so, you know, knowing that there was that much uncertainty and roster turnover on the horizon, they knew they weren't really going to be able to keep both Jeff Teague and Dennis Schroeder. And they felt like, you know, they got a good return on the Teague trade. And they made Schroeder a full-time starter because, you know, honestly, he was pretty much equal with Teague last year. And in the postseason, when there was four key fourth quarter minutes against the Cavs, Budenholzer opted for Schroeder over Teague a few times. And I think that was a clear indication that, you know, with a 22-year-old, you'd prefer the 22-year-old with the future over the, how old is Teague, maybe 28-year-old?
Yeah, yeah. And I think some advanced stats sort of implied that Jeff Teague was just really bad defensively in fourth quarters, and that was the thinking there. And I mean, it sounds like you agree with the decision. I think it's almost less complicated than some people put it out to be because of some of these things, you know?
Yeah, I mean, if you have a 22-year-old playing equally as well as a player who's much older and potentially more expensive, you're going to go with the younger player, especially since, you know, the things that he gives them, defense and you know, the ability to get all the way to the rim, you know, that gives him an edge over Teague probably.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, one interesting thing about the way that Schroeder works with, you know, their big free agent signing, Dwight Howard, is that I think that getting all the way to the rim and the gravity created there has such a profound impact on the way that Dwight Howard crashes the offensive boards in a way that, you know, you might be able to assume that Jeff Teague driving wouldn't, you know? And I mean, Dwight Howard, you know, has been, I think, dominant on the offensive boards, and which I think has been huge for the Hawks offense. Because, I mean, it sort of limped along a little bit, I think.
Yeah, it's almost like a shift in philosophy. You know, I think when you put Howard into the mix and Schroeder into the mix, you're taking away from the passing. They're not going to be as good a passing team as that 60-win team. But they have the potential to be a lot better in other areas. You know, they have the potential to be better in rebounding. They have the potential to be better at defense. So, you know, you mess with the chemistry or whatever the identity of the team is. But, you know, I think they can live with Schroeder, especially because, you know, you don't need Teague to uphold the chemistry that he had with players like Horford and Korver, because, you know, now neither one of those players is there anymore.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I think that, you know, DeMar Carroll might be a part of that too, you know. I think there was a little bit of a drop off in terms of continuity with him leaving. And yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of roster turnover. I think that it's been a little semi Spursian in terms of Budenholzer's ability, you know, coming and just being able to shift philosophies sort of at the drop of a hat, depending on the way that the roster changes. And I mean, I think that the way that they're utilizing the center position and the way that Dennis Schroeder is, I think, significantly different from Teague, sort of puts that on display, especially if they're able to have some sustained success here.
Yeah. Speaking of the Spurs, you know, a couple of things. One is that kind of Budenholzer was a Spurs assistant for, you know, almost two decades.
Yeah, yeah.
And he, you know, he actually, you know, you talk about the Hawks, he actually coached Dominique Wilkins at one point. You know, he was like a video coordinator or something when Dominique was a Spur.
Wow.
But, you know, that kind of explains the Gary Neal thing a little bit. He's familiar with Neal as a player from his time there.
Oh, yeah. I see the connection there.
And then when Howard was signed this summer, one of the things Budenholzer said, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit because it's been a few months, but he said something to the effect of, you know, this is going to be us playing with a traditional role man. It's going to take me a little bit back to my roots in San Antonio. So, you know, I think
Tim Duncan? Or maybe with the Admiral.
I mean, just with a more traditional big man, because, you know, when the Hawks won 60 games, they were basically playing five out.
Right.
You know, with Perreault and Al, you know, you had centers who could shoot who weren't your traditional post-up centers. And so, you know, I think it was just a very different system than what he had in San Antonio. And you look at what's happened over the last few years, especially starting with the Thiago Splitter trade. You know, they acquired Splitter, then they acquired Howard. You know, I think they're trying to get a little bit more Spursian in their approach and having more of a traditional big man. And of course, the Splitter thing really hasn't worked out, but it indicates that shift in philosophy.
Yeah, the Splitter thing, I think, has been a little bit disappointing. I thought that he was going to end up being important to come back for the Hawks this year so that you could maybe take a little bit of the stress off of Dwight Howard because, sure. You know, he's had some back problems, some, you know, typical big man problems. But, you know, the Hawks were able to compensate for that loss at the center position with how have you felt about Muscala's play as of late?
Muscala, you know, he's brought a lot to the Hawks. He brings a lot of flexibility in that he can play with Millsap. He plays, I think, especially well with Millsap, but he also plays pretty well with Howard, at least at the beginning of the season. So, I mean, I think, you know, he's brought a lot of flexibility in that he kind of can pair with the power forward or pair with the center. He's not the quickest guy, but he gets out on shooters pretty well. He's good at contesting jump shots with his length. And, you know, one thing that really stands out, especially on this team, is that, and even more so without Korver, but he's really been the most consistent shooter from, you know, October to January. If you just look at the entire stretch of the season, he's been a 40% plus three-point shooter all along. And really no other player has had that kind of consistency. So he's really been their best three-point threat. And even though guys like Bazemore and Hardaway are coming on now, they weren't doing it at the beginning of the season.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like actually maybe, and this transitions well into another thing I wanted to discuss, Malcolm Delaney has been a little bit of consistency as far as shooting, if not like elite 40% three-point shooting, but at least knocking them down. In fact, he has been playing at certain points at critical times where you would think that they would go with Dennis Schroeder. They've been playing Malcolm Delaney, and I think almost their system runs a little bit better with Delaney. Do you think that says anything about Schroeder and his long-term potential, or do you think it's just like a youth thing?
I think if you look at Schroeder and Delaney, you know, Delaney's been pretty good with like the 18-foot pull-up. That's his shot. And he's been very consistent at that shot, and it's a shot that he can pretty much get any time. They're just really two different players. When it comes to three-point shooting, Schroeder has been the better three-point shooter. And again, you know, some guys have gone hot and cold, like Bazemore and Hardaway. Schroeder's been right around 37% the whole season. He's been a pretty good three-point shooter, not as good as Muscala or Korver or guys like that. But after those two, he's really been the most consistent three-point shooter. Delaney, though, He's a pro's. He's just a pro's pro. He's just a winner.
Yeah, I love Delaney.
It's hard to put into words what he does well. I mean, if you look at his shooting percentages and you go, ooh, but then you look at his plus minus and it's like, whoa, that's pretty good. And he just does everything. He's not enormous. You know, he's 6'2", 6'3". He's kind of solidly built. The things he does well is he doesn't make a lot of mistakes. He's a rookie, but he's a 27-year-old rookie who's basically been on championships ever since he went to Europe, and now he come back to play in the NBA. And you know, he's kind of a combo-y guard. He's not really a pure point guard, but he just makes winning plays. He tries really hard, which doesn't really seem like necessarily an NBA trait, but he just doesn't take plays off at all. And what he does especially well, in my opinion, is on defense, he fights over screens. It's just really hard to screen him. So he gives you a lot of nice defense on the ball. His season has gone a lot like the Hawks season, where it was kind of hot and then cold and then hot again.
Yeah.
I think for him, the cold part, you know, was a combination of he's not really used to the NBA schedule yet, where it's game, 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 game. He's used to the European schedule where it's game and five practices and then a game and five practices. And he also was dealing with a little bit of a badly sprained ankle in there too. So, you know, even though he had that lull, I still have a lot of confidence in his ability. And again, going back to his season, sort of mirroring the Hawks season, lately, you know, I guess the Hawks are 9-1 in their last 10 games.
Yeah.
That's a lot of that has been on the strength of their starters playing excellent defense. But if you go back to their, I want to say, 9-2 start, that was really a case of the starters kind of playing even. You know, Schroeder and Howard came in, and even though they were kind of unsure of, you know, their roles in the system and their, you know, their teammates and just all the nuances of the Hawks system, you know, the starters played well enough to kind of play even. And then what the Hawks were doing in that 9-2 start was just blowing teams out with a bench. And what they were doing is they were subbing Paul Millsap out early and then bringing him back in with the bench. And of course, he's terrific. They were playing Thabo Sefolosha off the bench at the beginning of the season. And, you know, all season long, he's been a fabulous defender. But, you know, Delaney was running the show, and then they had a few more players who were, you know, familiar with each other, or at least with everybody other than Delaney. So you're talking about the Muscalas and the Humphreys and players like that. But that bench unit was absolutely just destroying teams.
It reminds me a little bit of what Dwayne Casey has been doing for the last few years as far as the way that he's been using the Raptors bench to just blow teams out of the water and then, you know, just trying to like keep everything afloat with the starters. But I do think you're right that, you know, now with the way that the starters have been playing, and maybe it's not all that surprising, the starters have just been, you know, playing this really great defense and they've been able to rattle off a bunch of wins. I think looking at their starting unit, I think that you can project that that would continue going forward. But I wanted to get your take on that. Because you see Schroeder, I think he's a plus defensively. You can definitely say Bazemore and Dwight. I think Dwight's had a really underrated season, especially defensively and on the boards. I mean, Millsap, was, I think, you know, right behind Draymond Green in terms of best defensive power forwards in the league, you know, just as soon as or just as early as last year, I think he had a really underrated defensive season. So now right off the bat, you've got 4 out of 5 positions in your starting lineup just being locked down guys. I just wanted to see, you know, how much you think that that's a real thing and how much you think that they're going to be able to depend on their defense to, you know, keep churning out wins and, you know, keep making strides to the playoffs.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely who they are. If you look at, you know, you compare that 9-2 start to what they're doing now, they've actually shifted some of those bench units to the starter. Sefolosha is a starter. He, you know, before he supplanted Korver, but now that Korver's gone, he's, you know, sort of definitely the starter now. They don't stagger their lineup as much. Paul Millsap's playing more with the starters than he did at the beginning of the season, where he was getting a lot of minutes with the bench. So, you know, they kind of shifted their chips towards the starters and less towards the bench. But, yeah, they are definitely beating teams with their starters and their defense at this point. And they're like fifth in the league in defense at this point. And I actually think that there's the potential, once they get more familiar with each other, to do better than that. I know you mentioned sort of 4 out of 5 players being above average on defense, and I think maybe that left out Schroeder, but, you know, I think he has that kind of potential too. When you compare him to Teague, you know, I think he's got a little bit more mobility to keep people in front of him. He's got longer arms, so he tends to get more deflections and things like that and kind of get in the way a little bit more than Teague did. And he's very, very good at just anytime there's a loose ball, scramble, things like that, he can just kind of go in and just, you know, suck up the ball like a magnet. You know, maybe like Chris Paul in that regard, where he just always seems to kind of come out of the scrum with the ball.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that that is the case. And I think that, you know, an important part of that, beyond just Cephalosha shifting and them being able to build up some continuity after the first few games of the season, is, you know, you mentioned that Bazemore had some injury issues, and I mean, that was affecting his shooting, but I think defensively also, you know, he hasn't been, or he wasn't quite at full capacity. And I mean, for a guy who's listed at 6'4", 6'5", I think he's sort of an underrated defender too.
He is. You know, he has like a 7-foot wingspan, so right, he's not very tall, but he has good leaping ability. That may be a little bit mitigated by, you know, whatever's going on with his knee a little bit this season, but, you know, he's just kind of gets in the way. He was terrific in the election night win over the Cavs. They went into Cleveland and beat the Cavs, and both teams, I was going to say both teams are playing at full strength, but actually I think Korver missed that one. But yeah, he was terrific in that Cavs game. It was the most important Hawk in winning in Cleveland, which I thought was a surprise. But again, I think it all goes back to Howard. You know, he's been really terrific. I wrote a piece today for Hawks.com about how he's actually rebounding as well as he has at any point in his career.
Yeah.
If you measure it by rebounding rate, because, you know, he was getting more rebounds when he was playing in Orlando, but he was playing 38, 39 minutes a game. He's getting, you know, 13-plus rebounds a game now, averaging 29 or 30 minutes. And his rebounding rates are better than they've ever been. His offensive rebound rate is off the chart. I'm pretty sure he's still number one in the league, and he's doing it, you know, on short minutes.
Yeah, and you know, he's also been able to do something that I think has been really cool to watch, which is, I was a little bit skeptical about the way that he would work alongside Millsap, but it seems like, you know, defensively, if you can sort of depend on him to get the defensive rebound and let Paul Millsap push the break a little bit more than usual, I mean, Millsap's like a truck in transition, and that's something that I think that they haven't been able to do and utilize. It's a skill that Millsap hasn't been able to put on display when he was playing next to Al Horford, because, you know, it's not like Al Horford is going to be able to be the rebound vacuum that Dwight Howard is. So I think it's opened up some possibilities in that regard.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it does more of that in theory than it has in practice to this point. I don't know that they've necessarily gotten their fast break game full throttle yet. I think it's still a work in progress. But, you know, over the last 2 years before this season, before Howard got here, they had to do 5-man gang rebounds, right? Because they just have to go for a rebound and go tip, 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 and hopefully, you know, just kind of hope that eventually it would come down in the direction of one of their players, because they didn't have somebody to just go up and get it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they were, if you would take Horford at his word, they were playing two power forwards. I mean, I'm inclined to agree with him. I think that, you know, you've seen the Celtics have a lot of the same issues playing him at center. You know, he's not going to be able to do some of the things that Dwight Howard is able to do, especially in terms of, you know, sort of locking it down as far as rebounding. It's been interesting to see the way that it's affected that, you know, that fast break potential, that possibility of, Millsap being able to get into the open court. I think that, you know, you're right that the Hawks are going to round into form defensively as they sort of gain continuity. Would you agree with the idea that developing that fast break game is probably their best bet as far as, you know, being able to improve the offense? Because that's the real question mark for me anyways, is, you know, how are you going to be able to consistently create offense with this team? I think one of the answers to that would be sort of trying to utilize Dwight Howard on the boards a little bit more to get things going, because you can leak out Paul Millsap. You can let everybody run, you know?
Right. And part of it is just to go back to the defense for a second, because, you know, you talk about trying to secure the defensive rebound. Part of it is this weird shift, you know, from Horford to Howard, but also sort of from the old NBA to the new NBA. I try to put this into words, but let's put it this way. You know, if you looked at what the Hawks did last season, they had a terrific defense. Like, I want to say it was like second best defense in the league last year. They had this magnificent defense, and it was all predicated on blitzing pick and rolls. When teams would run a pick and roll, they'd send both defenders to the ball and just rotate behind it. But they'd try to trap. They'd try to get their hands in the way. They'd try to get deflections and force turnovers and do things like that. That kind of a defense messes with your rebound. So, you know, Horford wasn't necessarily the worst rebounder. Part of it was just that he was really, really good at trapping on the perimeter, which left him 23, 25 feet from the hoop at times. And so he wasn't going to necessarily get the rebounds at those times. Now they've got Howard, and there's this little bit of adjustment period, because that's not necessarily Howard's strength anymore.
Well, I've seen him get out on offensive players, and I saw him, I'm pretty sure just a couple of games ago, he blocked someone at the three-point line. But
yeah, he's getting better at it.
But and yeah, so it's definitely not his style if you think about his career.
Yeah, Budenholzer said last week, you know, it's not necessarily his first instinct, but over the course of the season, he's gotten better at it. It's a change to what his natural instinct is to do. And I think it's a change from even what Bud might want from the perspective of, you know, what does it mean to have that traditional big man that he's been searching for the last couple of seasons? Well, you know, even if you want to kind of play a drop back pick and roll defense, you know, this is a new NBA where the 3-point line means something different than it did 5 years ago. And teams are running different types of offense and making different types of choices in the shots that they take. And so, you know, they got to kind of reconcile all this and figure out what's going to be the best fit for them on defense. But they've got, you know, really interesting pieces to do things with in that department.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I think their pick and roll defense is really interesting. It's almost like that old Thibodeau Bulls where, I think you would probably agree with, the idea that the way that you respond to any pick and roll in any given situation is the most important thing you're going to do on defense in the vast majority of possessions. And when you've got a guy like Dwight who can drop back, and you can sort of start to, okay, all right, we know that you don't want to get out and contest, but sometimes we're going to go against Steph Curry, and you're going to have to do that. Well, if you can develop that skill, now we can go out. And then also you have these guards who can fight over screens. You mentioned that Malcolm Delaney does that well, and Dennis Schroeder does it well. And then you've got this lockdown guy, Thabo Sefolosha. That's why I'm thinking that, you know, yeah, the defense has been great, and like you said, they're fifth in the league, but I think that this defense could be even better eventually as they, you know, start to learn how to communicate really well in terms of, okay, this is the way that we're going to play this particular defensive situation, whether we're going to ice it or flash or, you know, try to use Cephalosha to dig or sort of be flexible in terms of what they're facing on a team-by-team basis.
Right, and they want to be able to change coverages in the game and change multiple times throughout the course of a game and give teams different looks and different players different looks. But, you know, it's still on the learning curve at this point because you're two of your most important pieces are Schroeder and Howard, and they're getting used to new roles.
Right.
So I think you're starting to see now what they can do. But you know, to go back to what you were saying before, you know, the question marks are going to be, well, what do they do on offense?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's where I was going to go from here. I was going to see what you thought as far as if you were Coach Budenholzer, what your ideas are. You know, maybe starting with, you know, if this is the starting lineup, this whole Bazemore, Cephalosha, Dwight Howard, Dennis Schroeder, Kent Bazemore, I mean, what are your ideas in terms of making that work? Is that what you want to run with? Because your offense might be limited just, you know, period. You know, there's nothing to do.
Right. I mean, I think they're doing a lot of, well, I should amend that a little bit. Other than the fact that Dwight is a role man and really, you know, they're doing a lot more pick and rolls compared to the pick and rop. Compared to the pick and pops that they've done the last couple of years. Other than that, it really looks like they're running the same sort of motion offense that they've run all along. The difference is that with fewer shooters, you know, without Korver, and, you know, as they try to get Bazemore and Hardaway into being the shooters that they can be, the spacing has been pretty bad. And, you know, early in the season, what they were having trouble with was just turnovers. They were turning the ball over so much.
And that makes sense with the lack of spacing.
Exactly. And I don't think that they necessarily want to do anything different. I think they just want to be crisper.
Right, yeah.
In terms of their passing and just kind of be cognizant and realize what that spacing is and be a little bit more careful with the ball. I don't think they necessarily want to do anything drastically different other than just get used to making those passes in tight spaces.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm laughing because that reminds me a little bit of the philosophical shift that the Spurs did recently, where they had the continuity built up so that as they went towards, you know, LaMarcus and Kawhi being on the inside and, you know, away from the really well-spaced floor with Boris Diaw and the whole beautiful offense thing, you know, they were able to execute with the decreased spacing that I think happened in terms of the transition to having two bigs and all of that and running, you know, maybe a bit more 90s-style stuff. I think that that's what Budenholzer is sort of hoping is that they can sort of replicate that Spurs thing that happened, you know, again, right? So that they can play, you know, this, they can have the same ball movement without being concerned about spacing and just it being cramped. And it's interesting because they're bringing in and out all these free agents, and it's really hard to build that continuity offensively if they're doing that. So I guess you would hope that this team, you know, not only sticks together and they don't make more moves, but that they do that for at least a couple of years, because I think that, you know, offensively, you're not going to be able to develop that chemistry unless you can really stick together for a little bit of time. Do you think that's realistic?
Yeah. I mean, if you look, I think their core on offense is Schroeder, Bazemore and Howard, and, you know, they've got to figure out what they're going to do around those two players. Are they going to try to keep Cephalosha? That might be something that they're aiming to do. You know, one thing that they haven't utilized as well as they should be able to utilize is Dwight as a role man. I don't think that they've gotten too comfortable.
I don't think that Dwight likes being a role man.
I mean, it's tricky. He prefers he might prefer the pick and roll, but
or prefer post ups.
He might prefer post ups, but what they've been using him for a lot this season is sort of as the duck in guy. They'll run the Schroeder Millsap pick and roll, and they'll let Millsap make the decision with the ball on the short roll, you know, whether he wants to kick out for three, take the floater himself, or if the defense comes over and helps, you know, he can get the ball to Howard over the top, who's ducking in from the baseline.
And that's made Dwight, I think, a real threat on the offensive boards too.
Sure. But what they haven't done is, I don't think that this necessarily gotten a good feel for Dwight as the role man. And, you know, they've actually been pretty productive in that capacity, in that, you know, if you look at like his points per shot numbers, you know, he's been pretty good at that. But I just think overall there's more that they can get out of it. And one area that they can get out of it is better lob passes. They haven't been great at feeding him that pass over the top. He doesn't really like the ball down low when he's rolling. You don't want to get it down near his knees or below his waist. He's really a lot more comfortable catching the ball up high, whether it's just catching a regular pass above his waist or catching it way up high over the teeth of the defense.
Yeah.
Bazemore has been pretty good at throwing that pass, but the rest of the Hawks seem like they could get a little bit better at it. And I think Millsap's been pretty good too. But what we, you know, a lot of that has been, like we said before, where Millsap's the role man and Howard is ducking in. What they have really only started doing in the last couple of weeks is they've started to incorporate some Millsap-powered pick and rolls, which I think have a lot of potential, especially if you put some shooters around them.
Well, I mean, if you want to create some offense in the short pick and roll, that's easy. Just go out and get LeBron. and this can maybe be our lead out because it touches on some of the Hawks' young promising players. It seems to make sense to me that, you know, perhaps the missing piece, if, you know, you want to run with Schroeder long term, and that'll be interesting to see. I think that there's probably not anyone on earth who knows whether he's going to reach his full potential, so it's just sort of, you know, sit back and hope for the best. And then if you're running with Bazemore and Dwight and presumably Millsap, if he re-signs, which I think is maybe a thing, the big question mark is small forward, right? Especially with the way that Thabo Sefolosha impacts the spacing on offense. So you look at their recent picks in Bembry and Prince, and that makes a little bit of sense. I've heard a lot of buzz about Bembry. What's your insight onto him and how long you think he's going to be ready to potentially slide into a starting role if you think he is going to be able to do that eventually?
I think he's got a lot of potential. He's very athletic. He can, even though he's not that big, he's kind of a kind of player who's maybe somewhere between a one and a two. Even though he's not that big, he can get up and play above the rim. He can make sharp backdoor cuts to the rim. He can handle the ball really well. But what I think, you know, one thing he definitely has to get better at is he has to get better as a shooter. So he, you know, he has more potential than maybe someone like Tim Hardaway Jr., If and that's a massive if, he can get better as a shooter, because he could be a better defender, a better passer, you know, a better overall player than Hardaway. But Hardaway is a pretty magnificent shooter, even though his 3-point numbers have never looked that great. He's a guy who can kind of create his own shot and make it look pretty good when he's taking it. So, you know, I could see them trying to shift towards Bembry, but the shooting's going to be that one thing that he really has to work on. The other player, Taurean Prince, he's really got a lot of potential. He's big. You know, he's like Kawhi, Paul George kind of big. He's a big small forward. He's a little bit older, so he's not, you know, it's not like he's this 19-year-old who's going to have this massive learning curve over the next couple of years, but he already looks like a guy who can play now. He can shoot, he can really defend, he moves around the court with a lot of athleticism. I think he can pass, he can handle, I think a lot of people compare him to Damari Carroll, but he's different in that he can do a lot more with the ball in his hands than Carroll could. The one thing that he's got to get better at is he's got to get better in learning the system. There have been a lot of times, I think, where he comes into the game, and a minute after he's in, you know, he's getting yanked out for a mental mistake.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's interesting that he's been able to play off the ball. I know going in to or coming out of the draft, that was one of the question marks around his game. And then shooting, he had a little bit of a drop off in his last year in college, especially from the free throw line. This year, he's been hitting. I mean, he's nearly at 40% from the field goal, and on a very limited sample size, 14 of 16, he's been really good from the free throw line, but I don't know if I trust that, because it's just 16 attempts.
Sure. No, but just watching his stroke and practice and things, he can shoot.
Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting to hear. He can shoot. Because
I think his ceiling, and this is like I said, you know, this is a long way off, and he's got to do things like, you know, not make the mental mistakes and earn Bud's trust and things like that. But, you know, I think his ceiling is somewhere, and this is crazy, but I think it's somewhere around Paul George, that's the type of player he can be. You know, it's kind of that big, small forward who can do a little bit of everything, especially defense. I think that's him.
Well, Paul George would be a really good fit, I think, at the three position. So
he might be the player they're looking to fill that role. I think Bembry isn't necessarily the small forward. I don't think that's even his position. But I think, you know, Prince could be their small forward, if not next year, the year after that.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And I guess that would depend a little bit on development. And then I think that they've collected like a good amount of draft picks, you know, all over the place, in terms of like second round picks, late first round picks, you know, middle of the draft type of stuff. And one thing I've always...
So junk picks.
I'm sorry?
Which I think is part of the... I was going to say, so mostly junk picks.
Oh, well, I was going to say, one of the things that I think I have the most confidence about in the Hawks organization is their scouting, though.
Right. And that Minnesota pick could turn out to be a very good pick if... I think it would be... I think it's summer of 2018, so if the... It's lottery protected, so if the Timberwolves were to, say, eke out a 7 or 8 seed next year, that would be the sort of an optimal scenario for them to get a good pick. But, you know, most of those things, the picks that they have, their own, Cleveland's, and those second-rounders, you know, that's all kind of roulette picks where you kind of hope that the player you pick there pans out. They don't have a bunch of rock-solid picks, and I think that's the thing that might scare them from trading Millsap is, you know, if you trade Millsap and get those types of picks from a playoff contender now, those are picks where you might have a chance of getting a really good player. But you could say the same thing about going to free agency too, which is you might have a chance of getting Millsap back and having a foundational type player come back for a few more years. They might just want to take that chance instead of the chance of picking a young guy in the, you know, in the first round in the 20s.
Well, but hey, they drafted the next Chris Paul at 17, and then the next Paul George at, I think, like 11. So, I mean, or 12, I guess, was the pick. So, I mean, sure. You can count on that at least.
Right. So Schroeder, you know, that was,
yeah,
that was
a weird, I know.
That whole draft. I mean, they almost got Giannis in that spot because that was just bizarro draft. But in general, I think, you know, I think there are some parallels with, almost with like the, you know, the Spurs when they traded and got Kawhi. I think there's a lot of parallels with that and what the Hawks did this year with Prince. They kind of just eke into the late lottery, pick that big defender at small forward. I think there's a lot of parallels there. I don't think he's a Kawhi type player, but I think he might be something like a Paul George type player.
Yeah, yeah, no, and that is very similar.
That's super optimistic. I don't mean to say the ridiculous, but that's his ceiling, and then of course, you know, there's his floor. But
yeah, well, and I mean, I like picks like that for franchises like the Hawks. It certainly worked out for the Bucks with Giannis. But yeah, I mean, you would think that you know, trying to go for the transcendent player year after year and sort of recognizing that they might not work out. I mean, even if there's like a 1 out of 5 chance of getting a player like that, you have to jump for it, especially I think with the way that the Hawks roster is constructed.
Sure. I mean, you look at the Spurs, you know, actually that's an analogy even beyond the Bud Popovich thing, is that the Spurs and the Hawks are the two teams that have, I think, made the most consecutive playoff appearances in their respective conferences. And so if you never get a lottery pick, you know, you occasionally got to take that chance when you think there's a player who's going to be there at a late lottery spot who can kind of turn into an above average NBA starter. You have to take those chances every now and then.
Yeah, definitely. Well, so very last thing I was going to ask you about, you know, if you had to guess as to where Paul Millsap will be by the start of next year, you know, first game of the 17-18 NBA season, what's your guess?
Do I get one, or can I cover my bases a little bit?
You can cover your bases.
How about... if you gave me two places, I would say Atlanta, Denver.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
And but really, I would say four. I would say Atlanta, Denver, New Orleans, Orlando.
Oh, so you don't think the Raptors?
No, I don't think the Raptors. I don't know. I mean, maybe they could put together a package that really appeals to the Hawks, but I don't know that they have. I don't know that they have the picks. You know, they have sort of young players, but not young transcendent players. And I don't know that they have a draft pick to put with it to make that kind of deal.
Oh, well, they have the Clippers pick. And, I mean, did you hear about Chris Paul's injury? I mean, really, though, that might be decent.
Is that unprotected?
I believe it is. But, you know,
yeah,
let's assume it is.
Yeah, man, that was a crazy trade too. Was because that was the pick that went through the Bucks.
Yeah, I think it was that one. They traded where they waived.
It was Carlos Delfino and Miroslav Radulica for a first round pick and Jared Dudley. The Bucks got the pick and Dudley for two guys that never played in the NBA again.
Oh my God!
And then the Bucks threw the pick away on Grievous Vasquez. Whoops.
What is the NBA, man? Why did these things happen?
I mean, even that kind of pick, I don't think it's going to be the kind of transcendent, I want to give up my chance on Paul Millsap pick. And, you know, I don't know. It's hard to even say who's necessarily, I don't want to say, making the calls, but there might be some consensus building as to, you know, maybe ownership wants to keep Millsap. Maybe they want to have a marquee name. I know he's not the biggest marquee, but the marquee of Paul Millsap's a pretty good player, and if he's here, the Hawks are going to win a bunch of games. That might be something that appeals to ownership, and maybe they say, you know what, we'd like to keep him. And, you know, I don't know if it's a max contract or something near a max contract, but, you know, that could be something where it's not just Budenholzer. Maybe there are other people, and they all sit down in a room and decide that Millsap's somebody that they want to try to keep.
Yeah, I mean, you do write for the Hawks. I wasn't going to ask you about the whole decision-making tree in Atlanta because, you know, you might not want to slander your employer.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm a contractor officially, but. Yeah, and I don't want to say anything too drastic, but to be honest, I don't know that much. I do know that I kind of asked a question and somebody else asked a follow-up question, and, you know, Bud said something to the effect of, yes, we're talking to ownership, but we talk to ownership all the time. It's a healthy conversation. So, you know, so they do converse, and so I'm sure that dialogue has been had, and, you know, they probably put the pros and cons to each other about what different ways they could go about things. And, you know, I'm it's probably a pretty healthy dialogue.
Yeah. And, that's something that you recently discussed on your, podcast ATL in 29. You should go check out that podcast and listen to it. I believe it was episode 17, they got into a lot of discussions about the decision making process and you know, some of the things that might potentially be happening behind the scenes. And it was a really interesting episode. I also saw that you just today, and I haven't gotten the chance to listen to it, had an interview with Tavares, right?
Yeah, Eddie Tavares, who was a center for the team last year.
Yeah, I remember that guy. He's like huge.
He is, yes. He's shaken my hand many times, and every time he shakes my hand, he also shakes half my forearm.
7'9" wingspan. He's playing for the Toronto 905, and like I said, I haven't gotten to listen to it, but if it's anything like the other episodes of ATL in 29, I can strongly suggest it. Yeah, no, thanks for coming on and talking Hawks, and I'll have to have you on again soon to, you know, talk about which direction they ended up going here. So, yeah, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time.